and welcome to the Science Podcast for March 6, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, using the market instead of patents to promote intellectual discovery. An enormous budget increase for U.S. science and the increasing demands of data-intensive sciences. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Have a great idea? Think it ought to be patented? If your goal is to make yourself rich, then go for the patent. Though your patent might not end up being the first, and even if it is, you still might spend a lot of time in court defending it. If, instead, you want to promote further intellectual discovery and make some money doing so, new research suggests that you might want to set up a market or invest in the potential components or materials that might go into making your idea work or make your great idea better. In a paper in this week's Science, Peter Bosart and colleagues report the results of their experiment showing that markets, instead of patents, may be the better way to go in some cases. I spoke with Bosart from his office at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Lausanne.
What we try to do is find an alternative way to promote intellectual discovery that's not based on a price system, a patent system. And the reason why we did this is because, you know, we realized that a patent system really works only if there are enough people actually think that they have a good chance of actually finding the optimal solution, because only the number one guy, actually the person who discovered things first, is rewarded. So we wanted to give the system that actually works with real humans who tend to be more modest of being about being the first all the time. So we know that people are, they may be more modest about being the first, but they are actually overconfident about being better than the median. And that suggested actually we should try markets where you can actually play out this very well. And so we set up markets as a way to promote intellectual discovery in a very particular way. And that's what led to these experiments. And these experiments really show that indeed it works, and it works better than using a patent system.
What are the key features of this market-based approach?
So the key features is that you need the components of your discovery to be traded somehow, or some claim to it to be traded, right? So we give the example in the paper of fuel cells, right? So you need platinum to be, or futures in platinum to be traded. If you think platinum is not a good thing, then of course you can sell short. That is, you can actually try to bet on price decreases of platinum. But it's important that these components are traded. So it would not work in a planned economy where there are no markets, where people cannot set up markets to trade the components.
But those with the skill or knowledge to solve a problem may not have the money to invest in these markets. Right?
That's correct. But that's true also with the patent system, right? In most cases, you know, people are being paid or given money, seed money or so, to think about developing an idea. That comes then most often from venture capitalists or angels or so nowadays. In the case of our markets, it could come from funds like venture capital funds who would be willing to take the positions that are needed to exploit a discovery. Because you know prices are going to have to change once the discovery is in the public domain. People are going to use it, and the old-fashioned way of doing things will actually become less valuable. So it does require, of course, that you need two skills. You need not only the skill of discovering something, but also the skill of investing and understanding markets. But that's where, you know, division of labor comes in. You know, venture capitalists are a lot better in doing that. So you leave that part of it to them.
How does this market-based approach differ from the cost book system, a 19th century method used to finance mining operations?
Yeah, actually, it's very similar. In the cost book system, essentially what they did is they dealt in shares directly in the teams that were developing new ways of, in this case, of producing energy through the steam engine. So it was betting on teams. It was like having, you know, bets on, you know, a team from Stanford versus a team from Harvard or something like that, right? Whereas here what we are really thinking about is you're not betting on the teams, you're betting actually on the effects that the invention will have on prices in the future. So for instance, you know, take platinum, for instance, right? If it is really true that platinum may not be the best way of producing fuel cells, then you know that the price of platinum is for a large part going to collapse. So then you'd actually take a position in platinum. And of course, once you have taken a position, you have all the incentive to tell everybody that, you know, this is a stupid way of doing things, and there's a much better way of doing things, and you just tell everybody, right? So essentially provoking the price drop that you wanted to have.
So this market-based system would potentially be better for society in terms of the speed of intellectual discovery, though not necessarily for the pocketbook of the inventor, him or herself. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I should say the only one really who would be better off in the patent system is the inventor who happens to win, right? Because don't forget there are other people who try to invent, try to do the same thing. Now, you know, in principle, it's not important that two or three people find a solution in an economy. The important thing is the solution gets found. However, down the road, when you think about discoveries that are based on past discoveries, very often there is a learning curve. You know, it's easier to discover something new if you've already done all the steps in the past, right? So then it actually matters that a lot of people actually have gone through the process of finding or discovering the right thing. The second thing, actually the most important thing, is the standard objection in economic theory against patents is the monopoly rights that are given in the aftermarket. So once the patent is given to the person, the goods or the services that are produced with the patent are in the sole control of this patent holder. And the patent holder may even decide not to even provide a good or the service, even if it's good for society as a whole. Right? And there have been, you know, many cases like that. Or if it is provided, it's provided in a suboptimal quantity, usually too little. Not enough people actually can enjoy the fruits of the intellectual discovery.
Take me through the experiment then that you and your co-authors performed in which you decided that this market-based approach would be better.
So here's what we did. So we asked our participants to solve what are called knapsack problems. Knapsack problems are actually notoriously difficult mathematical problems where you have to fill a knapsack with items. Not all the items can fit in the knapsack, and the whole idea is to actually take a selection from these items to make sure that the knapsack has most value, try to maximize the value. What makes it difficult is that the only way to be sure actually that you have the optimal solution is to list all the possible outcomes, all the possible combinations that you can put together for this knapsack. And that's the only way to do this. So that's what we asked them to do. Now, we rewarded them in two ways. In one treatment, we rewarded them through a prize system, a patent system. So we had, if you remember, all 20 subjects. And so they started to work on it. And the first guy to find the correct solution would raise his hand, and we would check the solution. If it's correct, we'd say, this is it, the person found it. Now, we had a second treatment, and that was the market treatment. And that we actually did not give direct incentives. What we did, we gave everybody a share in an item, potential item in the knapsack. That is, if there were 10 items, then there were 10 different shares being traded, like different stocks or different commodities or something like that. Right? So you could buy and sell at any moment in time at prices that you posted, and you would just have to wait until somebody actually took those posted prices. When an item ended up to be in the optimal solution, in the optimal knapsack, then the corresponding share paid $1 dividend. If the item was not in the optimal solution, it paid nothing, so it was worthless. So here the situation then was that, you know, I'm a participant there, and I'm given all these shares for all the items. I would actually like to sell, to get rid of the shares of items I don't think are ever going to be in the optimal solution, and I would like to buy a little bit more of the shares of items that are in the optimal solution, because, you know, I'll make money. So I start trading based on what I think is optimal. So everybody actually now has an incentive to start, you know, actually looking for a good solution. And that's it. That's the description of it.
And through this process, more people were able to come up with the right solution or no?
Yes, that's correct. So more people were able to come up with the right solution. It was also clear that the prices conveyed some information as to what the right solution was. So it is very different from classical information aggregation problems. It's a really much more profound, much more difficult problem that I think actually, or that we thought, corresponded much better to what intellectual discovery is about. You know, you have to really think about combining things in a very original way, and it will work in one way, but won't work in other ways.
So one might argue if one's overall goal is to make a whole bunch of money and not worry so much about promoting intellectual discovery, one would still sort of hold on to the patent system. But if your goal is to promote intellectual discovery society-wide, then you might say, as an inventor, I'm going to release this to the public and open up markets on it. Is that the idea?
That is the idea. That is correct. Now, there are limits to the market system, just like there are limits to the patent system. So the limits of the patent system is that in many cases, it's not clear what the intellectual property is about, where the boundaries are. For instance, whether DNA sequencing can be patented is an example of that. In the market system, if you cannot point to some goods or services whose prices would actually would change significantly upon introduction of the new technology or the new discovery, then it's going to be very, very hard to actually use markets as a way to incentivize discovery in that field. Right? So both of them, both systems have their limitations.
Peter Bosard, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Peter Bosart is senior author of a paper on promoting intellectual discovery through markets instead of patents. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, domesticating and milking horses. Alan Outram and colleagues report in a paper three new pieces of evidence that suggest that the ancient Botai culture domesticated horses as early as 3,500 years before the Common Era, the earliest evidence to date of the domestication of horses. The first piece of evidence came from ancient Botai horse bones, which resembled those of the Bronze Age domestic horses rather than those of the Paleolithic wild horses from the same region. The second piece of evidence came from markings on the animal's teeth, indicating that the horses were bridled. Finally, researchers also found Botai pottery fragments and, using isotope data, identified fat from horse milk, suggesting the containers had been used to store the horse milk or other products from the horse carcass. The research also indicates that the practice of milking animals developed independently from other agricultural practices because it happened far from the Fertile Crescent where conventional agriculture is thought to have begun. The Botai culture lived in what is now northern Kazakhstan, where today horses are used for both meat and milk. Amid all the gloom of the current economic crisis, the recently approved U.S. stimulus package is a real boon to science. In this week's issue, Deputy News Editor Jeff Mervis reports on how the money going to science agencies will be spent. Jeff, first of all, out of the $787 billion, how much of that money is going to science?
Research gets roughly $21 billion. That's a small percentage, but it's a significant increase for the scientific community. Most of that money is in research grants of one kind or another. About $3.5 billion is specifically for construction projects, new or renovated facilities, or large instrumentation.
And this is on top of a 2009 spending bill, as well as a planned increase in the 2010 budget. Is that right?
Right. The big news, of course, is that this is a large influx of money in 2009. For the National Science Foundation, for example, it takes its budget up by more than 50%, which is a huge increase. NIH actually gets more dollars, but NIH is many times larger than NSF.
Who gets the credit for bringing this money to the scientific enterprise? Is it current politicians, or is this one of those instances where current politicians are taking the credit from past politicians who've set this into motion?
Well, I think good news has a thousand fathers, to paraphrase. So there was a lot of support for increasing research in Congress, in the previous administration, and in the new administration. The logic behind that is that even though short-term spending on roads and sewers will put people to work, you want to create jobs that are going to be there 10 years from now. And one of the best ways to do that is to increase your scientific capacity. And so this money is supposed to help the country innovate by funding basic research, which will translate down the road into new technologies and new industries. In the short term, the supporters of science point out, it will also create jobs because grants include scientists, postdocs, graduate students, and they also spend money on equipment and instrumentation, all of which helps companies get back on their feet.
To the distribution of this money that's coming in, does it reflect any change in emphasis favoring one science field over another from past spending on science?
Well, part of the stimulus bill does reflect a commitment to increase spending on physical sciences, specifically the National Science Foundation, the Office of Science at the Department of Energy, and the National Institute of Standards and Technology. So it's no accident that those agencies get large increases in the stimulus bill, as well as healthy increases in the 2009 budget, which is just finishing up in Congress. But NIH always has its supporters. And at the last minute, Senator Arlen Specter managed to add $6.5 billion to the stimulus package, giving NIH a total of $10 billion, which makes it the largest recipient of federal research funds.
With all of this extra money, is there any concern in the government or among scientists that this money will go to projects that don't deserve to be funded?
That's a very good question that's asked in Washington, but all the agency officials and certainly the scientists say no problem. They say we have a backlog of several billions of dollars of good proposals that have gotten excellent reviews that we couldn't fund because we don't have the money. And so most of the agencies are planning to just dip into their existing pool of applicants, increase the success rate, and pass out the money that way. That's also will be quicker than having a new competition with new proposals. So that's good news for any scientist that has an application in the pipeline. But indirectly, it's also good news for other scientists because the more grants that an agency funds out of the stimulus, the more money it has left to fund grants through its regular appropriation. So as far as the scientists are concerned, this is a rising tide that will lift all boats.
What, if anything, are critics saying about this expenditure on scientific research, given the overall financial climate?
Well, the criticism really is in two parts. One is it really going to have a stimulative effect? This is, after all, basic research with long-term impacts. And I think the scientists acknowledge that it's not going to turn around a failing industry or a failing city overnight. But at the same time, they say this is something that will pay off in the long run for the economy. The other criticism is a part of a broader concern that we're just increasing the deficit to a level that isn't sustainable. And even though science is only a small part of a trillion-dollar deficit, it still is a part of it.
And finally, then, what does this additional spending mean for the rest of the world?
Well, I think the rest of the world looks to the U.S. for clues onto how to respond both to the economic crisis and to innovation. And both those counts, you know, what the U.S. government is saying is investing in science is a good thing. So if that message carries over to other countries, and there are signs that it will, you know, other governments may try to do something similar on their own scale.
Any of the money going directly to internationally funded projects?
No, actually, there are some provisions that prevent much of the money from going overseas because Congress naturally is concerned about having it spent in the U.S.
Jeff Mervis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science Deputy News Editor Jeff Mervis writes about the 10 U.S. science agencies that receive research and construction funds from the massive economic stimulus package. Also in this week's Science, responding to possible plagiarism. In a policy forum, Tara Long and colleagues from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center report the results of their questionnaire about possible plagiarism. After identifying 212 pairs of articles with signs of potential plagiarism, the team sent the questionnaire to authors and editors of both the earlier published paper and the later, possibly plagiarized paper, and got a wide variety of feedback. The authors suggest that variation reveals a great deal about the attitudes and motivations of scientists around the globe, including why some journal editors do not pursue obvious cases of duplication. You can see a sampling of responses from authors and editors in the team's paper in this week's Science. Also, read a related News of the Week article by Hao Xin on scientific misconduct and alleged fraud in data concerning studies of traditional Chinese medicine. A gigabyte, or a billion bytes, used to be a large amount of data for a scientific experiment. Then came experiments generating terabytes of data, thousands of gigabytes, or trillions of bytes. Now, large-scale experiments can churn out data by the petabyte, 1,000 terabytes, or a quadrillion bytes. The amount of machinery and power needed to process all that data in a reasonable time has meant the introduction of new computing strategies, including cloud computing, which takes advantage of scalable components of virtual computing power over the internet. But so far, there are no clear examples of successful scientific applications of clouds, according to Alex Saleh and colleagues in a perspective in this week's Science. Instead, the authors write, making optimum use of such services and handling such data-intensive science will require some radical rethinking in the research community, meaning a new paradigm for science. I spoke with Saleh from his office at the Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland.
So the nature of how we do science is changing very dramatically as we speak. And there have been several traditional scientific paradigms. And the first one was science was empirical. We described nature. Then we tried to capture nature in equations. So that was the analytical paradigm for science that started with Kepler's laws and kind of culminated in the general relativity of Einstein and the quantum field theories. And then a new scientific paradigm emerged in the 50s that people called computational, where we tried to simulate the complex phenomena that were too complicated to solve the equations on computers. And what is recently emerging is something even more interesting. We call this new paradigm e-science, or data-intensive science.
Are there any examples of where the amount of data has or threatens to significantly slow down research because of the time it takes to analyze it?
It is becoming a challenge. So, for example, the Human Genome Project is one example. So, first of all, the amount of data was first, enabling us to do actually the gene sequencing, because what had to do previously in the wet labs, then it was translated to computers and software, and it was much easier to run it in parallel. But when we want to scale it up, that, in 2 years, the vision is that probably sequencing a genome, the personal genome, will be every day, so it will be less than $1,000. This will require enormous computational resources, and also storing the full genome is about a terabyte. So the hospitals are already bracing for this to happen. Medical imaging is another part. So Johns Hopkins today has probably over a petabyte of medical imaging data already. And it definitely stretches the institution's ability to cope with it.
And expanding the parallel computing clusters, often called Beowulf clusters, isn't enough to solve the problem?
Nope.
Why not?
Well, so the Beowulf machines are sort of typically the same machines as we use, or very similar machines to what we use on our desktops. So these machines were built for general purpose. That was the big advantage for science, so that, we could essentially leverage the economy of scale. So these machines were produced on the scale of millions, and so therefore they were very cheap. But so it turns out when we are building today bigger and bigger and bigger clusters, then they are draining more and more power. And since the scientific data is growing roughly at, it's doubling every year. So today we have a big Beowulf cluster at Hopkins that consists of about 400 machines, and it's already taking a substantial part of a megawatt. And so if we wanted to double this or quadruple it over the next few years, we would basically have to turn up the lights on campus. So that's one part of the story. The other part of the story, that the typical applications that these machines have been built for is not terribly data-intensive computations. But it turns out that as we need to deal with more and more data, we have to get somehow the data off the disk and into the CPU for the computations to happen. And the CPUs have been growing much, much faster. The speed of the CPUs has been growing much, much faster than the speed of the disks, simply because the chips are in silicon and the disks are still, by and large, electromechanical. And this increasing gap means that it's the distance between the disks and the CPUs is every 18 months, it's a factor of two larger. So I think what is going to happen over the next few years is an incredible compartmentalization or specialization in scientific computing. So we will have to build special machines which are capable of processing the data. We have to build other types of machines which are capable of performing very fast floating point computations, but the one-size-fits-all model is going to go away.
What about the server-side databases that many astronomers like yourself use, or the data system designed to capture, say, the data from the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, so these are kind of the, right now this is the only way out, so that we basically, the traditional way was that we brought the data to our computers, because the computers were expensive and moving the data was cheap. But this was only cheap because the data was small. And so today what is emerging is that we have to move increasingly the computations where the data is. So you should think about the data as this huge, heavy, sort of difficult to move thing. And so today we are bringing all our computations to the data, plus we have to build such computers which are able, capable of sifting through the data very, very quickly. So this is happening both at CERN. So they are building also special machines to sift through the data very quickly. This is what we have been building at Hopkins. This is what people at Google have been building, or at eBay, or at Microsoft. So the server-side computing is the emerging paradigm, but even this will face difficulties because of this power issue. So in order, the data is going to grow faster than our ability to absorb the heat coming from the computations.
Now, you're at Johns Hopkins, and your two co-authors are from Microsoft, and you also write in your perspective about your work with computer scientist Jim Gray, who was focused on this data-intensive science. From that vantage point, is clouds the way to go, or?
Yeah, so first of all, it is, to me, it is still not 100% clear that the cloud computing will take over sciences or will be a dominant form of scientific computing. So typically what we call clouds today is the commercial cloud. So a commercial facility which stores both the data and provides enough computing, and it is provided in a service-oriented fashion so that you essentially can rent an arbitrary number of virtual machines server side, which then perform your computation. And if you suddenly you need twice as many machines, you don't have to build up a twice bigger computational facility. You just pay for twice as many CPU usage or data usage or whatever combination of the two there. The clouds as they are designed today are probably not data intensive enough for science. So I think they are really designed to deal with the current issues happening in the business world, search engines. You know, that's the Google and MSN business model. Probably the closest to science usage is the way eBay is using its servers. But they don't talk about clouds. They built actually a special facility for themselves, which is probably the highest performance data-intensive computing facility in the world today.
At eBay?
At eBay, yeah. So they have 600 statisticians working on the analytics. So they analyze every mouse click, every user, every transaction, and they basically mine this information, this pretty complex multidimensional information, very much the same way as I would be mining essentially data from the sky, separating the typical from, you know, from the unusual patterns, which in eBay's case could be actually a fraudulent behavior.
Is there resistance among scientists that you've spoken with in learning this new way of thinking about science as basically data-intensive computing?
Well, yes and no. So generally the way it goes that the graduate students pick up the new skills. You know, there is this wonderful book by Thomas Kuhn about the nature of scientific paradigm shift in science.
The structure of scientific revolutions.
That's correct. So the way when he phrases that, the how a new scientific revolution takes place, that everybody accepts it, but I think the opponents slowly die out. And I think that will happen in this case.
Where the opponents will die out.
Yeah. But show me a scientist who did not want more data. So when the scientists would have to choose, okay, do I want twice as much data, or is it good enough to stop here and just leave me alone and let me write my paper? I would probably say that every scientist would say, okay, I would really like to double my data. So they do it, whatever it takes. So I think people are grudgingly but embracing this, I think, because they don't want to give up the ability to gather more and better data.
Alex Soleil, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Alex Soleil is senior author of A Perspective on the Demands of Data-Intensive Science and the Challenge it Presents to Many Scientific Disciplines. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. David, what's new?
Well, Rob, got three cool stories for you, like I always do. We're going to talk about how much energy you're wasting by drinking bottled water, what your spit says about you, and finally, how rotten egg gas may be the new Viagra.
So wasting energy with bottled water, is that because of the plastic bottles, the transportation costs? or what?
Well, Rob, it's everything. I mean, like you said, it's the plastic. It's also the labeling, the filling the bottles, even sealing the bottles. And as you said, transporting the bottles, cooling the bottles before they are consumed. All this stuff seems like it would waste a lot of energy, but nobody's really quantified it before.
And we're comparing it to what?
Well, we're comparing it to just drinking tap water, you know, filling a glass out of your sink.
And the cost of transporting that to your tap or in cleaning it and make sure that what comes from the environment is clean enough to drink.
Right. There are clearly energy costs associated with drinking tap water as well. But there still is a big difference between the energy cost of drinking tap water versus drinking bottled water. And that's what the study is all about.
I suppose it's sort of like personal transportation versus public transportation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, you know, say, you know, driving your own car versus riding the bus. And in this analogy, riding the bus would be drinking tap water.
So how many people are out there driving their own car or extending the analogy perhaps way too far, drinking bottled water?
Well, actually, the numbers really surprised me. It turns out that in 2007, people consumed 200 billion liters of bottled water. And Americans were the biggest gulpers, as it were. 33 billion of those liters came from the United States.
Where the tap water is clean.
Where the tap water is clean, right.
So there's no argument there for, well, you've got to have bottled water because it's unsanitary water.
Right.
Otherwise.
I mean, in most places, if not all places in the United States, the tap water is safe to drink. So there's no sort of health reason to drink bottled water in the U.S.
Concerns over fluorination or chlorination?
I guess so. But, you know, that's probably a story for another time.
Okay, so 200 billion liters of bottled water sold worldwide in 2007. The operative word then is sold. We're paying for the energy that's used. Even if bottled water ends up being more expensive than gasoline, what's the problem?
Well, the problem is, I mean, if you're using all of this energy, it's potentially bad for the environment. I mean, it costs oil or fossil fuel to produce this energy in the first place, and that means pumping carbon dioxide into the air, which is a greenhouse gas, bad for climate change, obviously. So the idea is if you can choose between two things, tap and bottled water, and one is much worse for the environment than the other, you know, and this is a case that environmentalists have been making for a long time. They've been saying we consume so much bottled water and we don't need to. What's the environmental impact? And the cool thing about this study is it was really one of the first studies to try to quantify what this impact is. And actually, based on the data in this study, Rob, it turns out that for every bottle of water you drink, it might as well be a quarter full of oil for the amount of oil that's being consumed in order to produce all of this bottled water.
And multiplying that by 200 billion gives me?
Well, we're talking about 50 million barrels of oil a year. And just for point of comparison, that's the same amount of oil used in the entire U.S. over 2 days. All the cars we drive, all the factories, all the lights we turn on, everything. So it's a really big chunk of the oil that's consumed.
Just from bottled water?
Just from bottled water.
Are environmentalists happy that people are recycling at least the bottles that they drink from?
Well, one of the authors of the study says recycling actually doesn't pay back a lot of these costs because when bottles are recycled, they end up as things like carpet or clothing or even toys. Most of the time, they're not turned back into bottles for bottled water. So, I mean, we're doing a good thing by recycling, but we're not necessarily offsetting these energy costs.
Okay. So which do you want to talk about next? What your spit says about you or the potential substitute for Viagra?
Well, I mean, while we're on the subject of liquids, we might as well talk about spit, right?
Okay.
And it has to do with all of these microbes that live all over our body. You know, we have tons of bacteria that live in our stomach and on our skin and on our tongue and everywhere.
I understand they outnumber our cells like 9 or 10 to 1.
That sounds about right. But what's interesting about these microbes is they don't just sit there. A lot of them actually help us out. The microbes in our gut help us digest food. And actually, recent studies show that if you have an imbalance of these gut microbes, it can actually contribute to obesity. And recently, scientists have been really interested in how all these microbes that live symbiotically with us contribute to our health or contribute to our diseases. But this study is not so much about disease. It's about what do our microbes say about who we are and where we live?
I remember there was a study about the bacteria in the gut being able to say something about where we lived.
Right. There was a recent science story that showed that a bacteria called Helicobacter pylori actually shed some light on human migrations in the Pacific. And this study actually started out by a team that also wanted to use bacteria to trace human migrations. But, you know, getting bacteria from the stomach is not easy. It actually requires a biopsy, which is not trivial. So this group wondered, is there an easier way to figure out, you know, what sort of bacteria inhabit a person? Could we get it from a cheek swab or even from spit? And so what they did was they went to about a dozen places all over the world, and they had 10 volunteers at each place basically give a spit sample. And they took these samples back to the lab, and they did a bunch of genetic testing on them, and they found in all these samples over 100 different species of bacteria, which is kind of gross when you think about it. But what was really interesting was that a lot of these bacteria had never been seen before. In fact, 39 of them had never been seen in the mouth before, and 64 of them had just never been seen anywhere before. So there was all these new species living in our mouth that we didn't even know about.
So with that data, did they find any correlation between the spit and the microbes living in the spit with the places that the spit came from, other than the mouth?
Oh, right. Well, yes and no. It turns out that there were some geographically interesting data. One thing was that people from California and the Congo had the greatest variety of bacteria in their spit, whereas people from the Republic of Georgia and Turkey had the least amount of variety. But beyond that, the researchers really expected to see some correlations. Like most people from California, they expected to see the same types of bacteria versus people maybe from sub-Saharan Africa would have their own species of bacteria. But what they found is there really isn't a link. Somebody from California may have a very similar population as somebody from Africa, and two people that live right next to each other in California may have very different populations of bacteria in their mouth. So there just doesn't seem to be this geographical correlation that researchers have seen with some other body microbes.
Do you suppose that might be because of international travel and, you know, the propensity of people to trade a little spit when they kiss?
Could be. Could also be diet. You know, different people, you know, you could be a meat eater and live right next to a vegetarian in San Francisco, and that could really make a dramatic effect on the type of bacteria in your mouth. So that kind of thing is going to need further research because the team really didn't look at these cultural factors.
What did they account for?
Well, they did account for other things like age and gender and rainfall and other factors. But, you know, diet's a biggie. And so clearly going forward, researchers will want to take that into account.
Okay, so finally, rotten egg gas. This is hydrogen sulfide?
Yeah.
As a substitute for Viagra?
Well, Rob, Viagra actually works by its own gas. It's gas called nitric oxide, and this is something that helps relax the blood vessels in the penis, and that leads to erection. But Viagra doesn't work for everybody, and this team was wondering, you know, is there anything else that may have a similar effect, but via a different mechanism?
And hydrogen sulfide.
And they turned to rotten eggs. And the reason they turned to rotten eggs, and it wasn't actually rotten eggs, but as you say, hydrogen sulfide, which is what we smell when we smell rotten eggs, is they saw some interesting preliminary data in penile tissue that was actually recovered from 8 sex change operations.
Why did the researchers look at hydrogen sulfide in the first place?
Well, actually, you know, hydrogen sulfide seems to play important roles in other parts of the body. It's a neurotransmitter, which means it can facilitate this crosstalk between neurons. But it's also been shown to regulate hormones and other things in the body. So even though actually hydrogen sulfide is toxic at high concentrations, in small amounts, it seems to be very important for our day-to-day functioning. So there was already some physiological basis that hydrogen sulfide might be important. And so that's why they decided to look at hydrogen sulfide in this new study. And what they found was in this penile tissue, they found a couple of enzymes that the body uses to produce hydrogen sulfide. So that was the first hint that it actually might play a role in erections or at least something important with the penis. And beyond that, they did some lab studies and they added a compound that turns into hydrogen sulfide to this penile tissue, and they saw a relaxation in the blood vessels. And this relaxation of blood vessels is what causes the penis to get erect in the first place. But they took it a step further, and they actually injected this compound, which turns into hydrogen sulfide, into the penises of anesthetized rats. And what they found is that the more of this compound they added, the stronger the erection.
So that delivery method doesn't seem particularly appropriate for people. Are they looking now for a pill or something like that that would get this compound into the right spot?
Well, that's the idea, that you would want a pill maybe that contained this hydrogen sulfide precursor that once ingested would actually turn into hydrogen sulfide in the appropriate place in the body and have the appropriate effect. But this whole talk of drug discovery is a long way off. As one expert points out, the concentrations of hydrogen sulfide they use in the study would actually be toxic to humans. And so they have to really find a way to make this work without side effects.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. What else are you looking into in Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how undesirable evolution can be reversed in fish. And the first discovery of binary black holes, and these are black holes that exist right next to each other. Now, we found a lot of black holes by themselves, but this is the first black hole pair that's been found. So that's pretty cool. And then on the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing to follow Obama's budget and what it means for science. There's also an item about the U.S.'s race to the moon with China. Is there really a race after all? And you can read up on that on the policy blog.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link for the latest science policy news on the Science Insider blog at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the March 6, 2009 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. Also, please fill out our short online anonymous survey at www.sciencemag.org/multimedia. It will be up for one more week. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.